Well, good morning. I see you're all ready to go. We're going to start with Rule Petition 1906. Judge Patak, you're going to be the presenter, and then Director Rothstein, you also are a presenter, correct? And then I have Attorney Dietrich, there he is over there, signed up to speak. Anybody else who wants to speak on 1906? Okay, very good. Then are you prepared to proceed? Okay, so Rule Petition 1906. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to see you all again in our series of hearings on our petitions that resulted from the work we've been now 3 years to this month in the process. For the record, I am Gerald Patak, a retired circuit court judge and a reserve judge, and I'm the chairman of the committee that you created, the OLR Procedure Review Committee. Now, today we're here on two petitions. I'm going to sort of make my comments to 2019-07. But our program today includes presentations by a number of people. On the first petition that's been called 1906 on reinstatement, I don't controversy, I believe the bottom and our committee all agree on what's to be done here, what should be done, and we're encouraging you to adopt these proposals, which are basically designed to increase the efficiency of the reinstatement process. You know, we all know that when someone's suspended for 6 months and then we wait for 18 months to get the reinstatement process created, it really ends up being a 2-year revocation, and that seems to be something that we should be able to do better with. And our proposal tries to do that. With respect to 1907, if I may skip ahead to that, that is entitled the confidentiality petition, and that we have a number of presenters from our committee to address issues in that petition to the court. I serve as the chairman, and we created a subcommittee structure, and each subcommittee had a chair. And the chair of that committee, Jay Rainey, is going to speak on the topic in 1907 directly. And he'll be followed by others, including Mark Baker, who is our non-lawyer member of our committee, Mike Apfel, who's going to speak from the standpoint of the law firm and their role in this process as it relates to lawyers informing their law firm of a violation or a complaint that might be filed. And then we have also Paul Schwarzenbart, whom you're familiar with as a litigator, who's going to talk about an anecdote that might help you understand why it's important that we feel attorneys tell a law firm that there's an issue that they have to deal with.
I think 1907, at least in my reading of the materials that have been submitted, is a lot more complicated than 1906. So to the extent that it's possible, I'd like us to focus on 1906, because when the court goes back and discusses this and votes on it, they'll vote on it petition by petition, though they might grant part of a petition and deny part of it. We do take the petition as almost like a case, okay? So it has its own identity for
yes,
us.
Yes. I just want to make one comment about 1907 from my perspective as the chairman of the I think one of the most difficult parts of this is to try to get input from people affected by this process. And I was somewhat frustrated by figuring out how we get input from the consumers, not lawyers, not judges, but the consumers who use legal services into this process. And our representative is Mark Baker, who's going to speak to that in this second petition. But I think it's important for us to understand our responsibility here as lawyers. And I know that the court does. The court understands its responsibility not just to lawyers and a process that's imposed here, created here, but also how we act to meet the needs and perhaps work to help protect the consumer. Because we want the consumer to be protected. We want the legal services consumer not to become a grievant in this process. And I think that's important. I think you realize that, but I think that is important to understand the perspective that comes from our committee when we dealt with the issues that are in 1907. right? So that's all I'd like to say at this point, and I'll turn the matter over to Jacqueline Rothstein, who will address 1906.
Very good. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I'm Jacqueline Rothstein, appearing today in my capacity as Chair of the Subcommittee on Reinstatement, rather than in my usual role as the Director of the Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners. Today, I speak in support of Rule Petition 1906, which addresses the reinstatement of an attorney's license to practice law following a suspension or a revocation. In particular, this petition seeks to consolidate, amend, and redesign the current rules governing the reinstatement process in a way that ensures due process for the attorney seeking reinstatement, allows the Office of Lawyer Regulation, otherwise known as OLR, to present its position on the reinstatement, enables members of the public to express their opinions about it, while still preserving the court's role in determining whether reinstatement is appropriate. Our proposal retains the substance of the current rules, but adds more guidelines to the reinstatement procedures. It also requires that more information be provided to the public and streamlines other procedures where appropriate. For example, the published notice about an attorney's petition for reinstatement would now alert the public that those who are interested may submit written comments about the petition to OLR, and OLR may also request that they be notified about any reinstatement hearing involving the attorney. It would further alert the public that anyone who submits comments may be contacted by OLR so that OLR can, if needed, obtain additional information from that person. Those amendments are intended to maximize the public's participation of and understanding of the reinstatement process. To enhance the efficiency of processing petitions for reinstatement, we have also proposed that a 75-day deadline be imposed on OLR both to investigate the attorney's eligibility for reinstatement and to inform the court as to whether the OLR director opposes the petition or whether the attorney has satisfied all of the criteria for reinstatement.
What did your work show was the usual amount of time that OLR spent to achieve those tasks?
I don't know that we specifically had a number that applied to their investigation. What I can tell you is that, generally speaking, even if you are suspended for as little as 6 to 7 months, it can take you almost 18 months to get back into practice, back to be reinstated. So this is an effort to condense the timeline and so that people can get reinstated more rapidly than has been the case in the past.
Have you determined why it took, 18 months for something you're now saying 75 days should be sufficient?
I think probably there may be a variety of reasons for that. Sometimes the but frankly, from the BBE, are given a longer timeline, and the goal is to shorten that up. And part of it may also just be people not being timely and getting responses in. This is an effort to hopefully move things along in a more rapid way.
Okay, thank you.
And how much of the process would get condensed into that 75 days? If it currently takes approximately 18 months for a six-month suspension, so figure 12 months of that for the reinstatement process, how much of that 12 months is going to be condensed into the 75 days?
That's a little tough for me to know specifically how much. I mean, hopefully all of the investigation. Now, I should also mention to you that the petition allows for an extension. So if OLR has good cause and can demonstrate to the court that more time is needed to look into the matter, then obviously the timeline is going to become extended. But the whole notion here is to also allow the parties, if they're in agreement, to move the process along more speedily.
So if there is an agreement, so say, let's say 75 days for the investigation, And if the director is in agreement that there ought to be a reinstatement, that would be submitted as a stipulated reinstatement petition, and then presumably within a few weeks after that, the process would be complete?
Correct. Although the petitioner, the attorney seeking reinstatement, may also supply a response to the director's report and would have about 2 weeks in which to do that.
Okay. So possibly this could shorten things up to, what, 4 months?
It could, yes. In the event the OLR director determines that an attorney has met the criteria for reinstatement, this proposal permits the director and the attorney seeking reinstatement to enter into a stipulation. If a stipulation is reached, the director must then file a memorandum in support to this court, setting forth any material issues that are potentially adverse to the attorney, including an explanation as to why that should not prohibit the reinstatement. The attorney seeking reinstatement may file a response to any such memorandum. All of that material and any written comments from the public must then be submitted to the court for its consideration. If the parties reach a stipulated agreement and the court determines that such a resolution is appropriate, obviously the need for a hearing would be eliminated. The subcommittee has also proposed an amendment to the provision governing stipulations in the disciplinary context to achieve greater consistency with both processes, that is, reinstatement and discipline. We have proposed that the OLR director may also submit a memorandum in support of a stipulation in a disciplinary matter, and that the respondent attorney may file a response to it within 14 days. The subcommittee believes that these mechanisms promote efficiency and will streamline the reinstatement and disciplinary processes. Ultimately, though, if the court rejects a stipulation or if the OLR director opposes the petition for reinstatement, the clerk of the Supreme Court would then select a referee to hear the petition, and a public hearing would then be scheduled.
So that's something that I had, I guess, missed in my reading. I was looking at the matters in 1906 as having to do with reinstatement. Now it appears you've said, and maybe you could refer me to the section, that it also includes discipline by stipulation. And that discipline by stipulation would then need subsequent court approval or not?
I'm sorry, if you catch your last question.
That discipline by stipulation that you mentioned would then need subsequent court approval or not?
Right, that would then also be submitted to the court.
So it would require court approval?
Yes.
Okay, can you tell me what section that is?
I am.
I think it's section 3, isn't it? I was kind of wondering why that was in this section as well, because that deals with the imposition of discipline, not with reinstatement.
I think the notion behind including that as well was to add consistency between.
As far as, I mean, I think the only change to that is that it gives the respondent an opportunity to file a response memorandum. Is that right?
It also allows the OLR director to file a memo in support.
Right, which has been pretty common practice up to this point. Right? Is that right?
I don't know how frequently, but I think in general that's true.
Yeah, because I think the memo said that we generally request a memo from OLR. So the primary difference here in Section 3 is that this would give the respondent an opportunity to file a responsive memo.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay,
I don't have, you know, I think that all makes sense. I was just kind of curious about why a disciplinary matter would be included in the reinstatement rule petition.
Again, I think largely to make the two processes more consistent, and if in fact the request is being made routinely that the OLR director file that, now it's memorialized within the rule.
Okay.
Is the discipline by stipulation without an evidentiary hearing, is that section 3 and it modifies SCR 2212.1? Just so I'm sure I'm on the right.
That's what
you're talking about. Okay, good. Thank you very much.
With regard to that section, I have a couple of concerns, or at least two concerns. This court has, for years, bantered around the idea of the issue of plea bargaining. And thus far, this court, although we've been split on this issue in the past, thus far the court has taken the position that there shall be no plea bargaining. It seems to me that this encourages plea bargaining. That's my first concern I'd like you to address. And second is the issue of restitution. To my knowledge, which can be informed by others, this committee did not tackle the issue of restitution. The court has written about this in several OLR cases. The policy of restitution thus far of OLR, and I'll paraphrase it, is that restitution cannot be ordered or will not be ordered, it's the policy of OLR, unless there is a some certain amount. We've had cases like the Cavana case, where there was a final accounting submitted by the lawyer. And then we've had cases where the lawyer couldn't, came up with a final accounting as to how much work the lawyer did or did not do. Ergo, the OLR took the position that since there's no final accounting, then there's no, they don't meet the test of a some certain amount, and therefore restitution will not be requested. I've consistently dissented. That's a nice word. Railed is more accurate. Against this policy, because I think it puts the burden on the wrong place. A case where the court took a different position was a case of Mwangi, in the medical incapacity of Mwangi, where the court said, no. There he couldn't find his files. And OLR said, well, we can't come up with a certain amount of restitution. And there the court decided to put the onus on, as I think appropriate, on the errant attorney rather than on the victim. And my recollection is that we set a test that was that restitution can be reduced by any amount that the attorney can establish to the satisfaction of the OLR, that it represents the value of legal services he actually performed. Now, I still have this concern about restitution, and it seems to me that Section 3 just continues the same and enhances the same concern that I have. That is, if OLR keeps its policy and then enters in a stipulation consistent with that policy, I'll just have to write a lot more dissents, and I don't want to. No, I mean that as an aside. It seems inefficient, because right now, the way that it's drafted, without addressing the issue of restitution, as I recall the way that the proposed rule is drafted, that you have the stipulation. It comes to the court without an evidentiary hearing. If the court has concerns about it, then the court sends it back to OLR. That seems to me to be inefficient. And I can, and I anticipate that I and maybe others on the court will have continuing concerns about restitution. So, what with that long preamble, what saith thou, Director Rothstein?
Well, I know that Judge Batak would be be interested in responding more specifically to you about the restitution. I will simply say briefly, and I'll turn it over to him momentarily, with regard to that, that you're correct. Our subcommittee did not address this issue, and as best I know, neither did any of the other subcommittees. And I'll let Judge Patak address that a little bit further.
As an aside, this issue came up to us last week at some point. I don't recall exactly how, but we have been searching our minutes and our proceedings to see whether it did come up in any of our committees or our committee as a whole. It did not. So I'm prepared to say to the court as a whole, if you wish us to look at this issue and come back with a recommendation, we'd be glad to do that. I would reconvene the committee in some form, perhaps by telephone conference, to discuss it, and then we'd get back to you on what our position is, and I understand what the issue is. Okay.
With regard to your first question, plea bargaining and whether or not this proposal encourages or enhances that, that really wasn't intended. I frankly think that this was intended to add a piece of efficiency to the matter. I don't think it was really intended to encourage or promote plea bargaining any more than it would otherwise if the parties enter into a stipulation on a disciplinary matter, or I mean, in this case, it would be a disciplinary matter.
I have a question that's maybe a little less substantive, I noticed in here, and I don't think this is actually a change from the prior rule, but the requirement to publish in a newspaper in all the counties where the lawyers practiced, as well as the state bar, a publication and on the website. I'm just curious, was there any conversation whether that's still worthwhile? I mean, generally speaking, newspapers are no longer the community forums that they used to be, and there's a lot of money that is spent, presumably putting ads out there, and I'm curious whether there was any consideration of whether that's still a good use of money and whether that actually yields results. Maybe that varies by location, but I doubt there's a lot of clients who are, reading the far reaches of the Journal Sentinel in Milwaukee to find out whether the lawyer that they had might have done something wrong, and I'm wondering if that still makes sense.
I think it's an interesting and a good question. I don't recall specifically addressing that within our subcommittee. As we become more and more of a social media and electronic society, whether or not the print journalism is the better way to go, I think, is a reasonable question to ask. Traditionally, the court has published in those forms before. And the more interesting point to me is I don't know, frankly, whether or not, in addition to putting it in the print papers, whether or not they put the notices electronically on the electronic forums for their online newspapers. I don't know the answer to that, Justice.
Director Rustin.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Director Rustin, I was looking at, what would it be? Proposed rule 22.30 sub 6 sub J, and this deals with the hearing before the referee if the director disagrees with the petition for reinstatement. So then there would be a hearing before the referee. And I note that, and I think this is probably similar to, or is the same as it is now, but I want to compare and contrast a couple of provisions on this and ask for your input. It says the hearing shall be conducted pursuant to the rules of civil procedure, but the rules of evidence shall not apply. Now, I know that under 22.16 sub 1, in the hearing, in the disciplinary hearing before the referee, the rules of evidence do apply. Is there a reason for that discrepancy? Why would it not? Why would the rules of evidence not apply in the reinstatement hearing that do apply in the disciplinary proceeding?
I don't know that I have a good answer for you, other than to suggest that perhaps the reinstatements tend to be a little less formal, perhaps, than the initial disciplinary proceedings, and perhaps that's what led to it. But beyond that, I suppose you could make them consistent and require both, although I don't, again, specifically remember addressing that within the subcommittee, and I don't know, frankly, if OLR would have any concerns about which I don't currently know about it.
Is there a reason that the reinstatement hearing would be less formal?
It's an interesting question. What I can tell you more generally is that administrative hearings for disciplinary matters in other professional licensing areas have a similar standard, and perhaps that was a consideration at some point.
A similar standard for reinstatement?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And actually, frankly, the discipline. The rules of evidence in disciplinary hearings, for example, with the Department of Safety and Professional Services, do not follow the lesser standard.
Mm-hmm. But here they do, right? So for disciplinary proceedings, we do require that
That's right.
rules of evidence be observed.
Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
What?
I don't know. My recollection is that the rules of civil procedure are followed, but maybe not the rules of evidence. I don't know the answer to that.
22.16 sub 1 covers disciplinary hearings before the referee, and it says that the rules of evidence do apply.
Thank you. There's another provision that I read recently that said what I indicated, and I must have had, we'll take a look at that in a moment.
Right. Yeah. 22.31 sub 5 is the current provision dealing with hearings for reinstatement, and that provision says the rules of evidence don't apply.
That's sub, yes, okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
The proposed rules.
Are you through, Justice Kelly?
I am. Thank you.
Okay. Why this dichotomy? Rules of evidence apply in one and not in the other.
I don't know the answer to that.
I had a couple of more questions, but I wanted to break to give my colleagues a chance to inquire. One deals with an existing provision that I think we have to, someone should take a look at. And it appears again here. What is that existing matter? Let me just take a quick look. I think it is in your section. Six A. Excuse me, but for me, Section 6 just says 22.31 is repealed. So,
okay.
What I'm referring to is the petition itself.
That's what I have before me.
Section 5, under Section 5, 6A, sub 6A?
That's right.
Under 5.
That's
Section
right.
5. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is what I just bring to your attention without asking a question. Add confusion. It's 5-6-A-B. A little hard to follow. At any rate, it says the referee shall have the powers of a judge trying a civil action. Now, our current rule has that also. But I've often been concerned, not daily, maybe not often, but I have in the past been concerned, that that allows a referee to have the power of contempt. And I personally am of the belief that contempt should be very sparingly used and not enlarged. I don't recall ever having a situation where the issue was raised before us. I know that Chapter 785, which is the contempt statute, indicates it has to be a court of record, and I don't think this is a court of record. However, there also is a separate provision, and you know, there's a difference between court and judge, right? And there's a specific provision that allows a judge to enter contempt findings and to hold someone in summary contempt, I'm talking about. So perhaps someone should look at that, since this is our existing rule. But I'm just wondering, when it says the referee shall have the powers of a judge trying a civil action, what are the ramifications of that vis-a-vis contempt and the provision 785, I can't remember, 03 something or another, specifically says a judge shall or can do summary contempt. The next concern I have is just a matter of drafting. Has this gone before the LRB already?
I do not believe that it has, but I'm not 100% certain of that.
The drafting of it.
It was submitted to LRB.
What was the final thing?
We did not get comments back.
You didn't get any, so they haven't had input or don't wish to give input one way or the other. The only comment I have is a comment regarding, just a drafting comment, regarding the use of his or her. And this contains, these redrafts contain his or her, and perhaps we should look at that to see if we want to, you as a court, use his or her in our phrasing. Do you understand what I'm saying? It looks like you're perplexed. Let me give you an example, I guess, and that might see if I have it.
Could you use the, for example?
Well, I think there would be what you're referring to, and there's a proper use of the word there as opposed to breaking it down into his or her, because that encompasses all ways in which people might refer to themselves. So I actually agree with that as a something that we should look at.
I'll object to the singular use of there, however.
Well, I was going to comment that then things would become plural, which...
Sometimes plural is the way to address it. We'll have to figure that out if there are others who have concern with the use of his or her. There are, as we all know, editing techniques to handle that. Okay, thank you.
Another justice have a question? Please continue.
The proposed rule also establishes guidelines for submitting documents and information to the referee, requires the referee to hold hearings at the earliest possible date, and to conduct the hearing in much the same manner as a judge trying a civil action. We do believe that these measures strike the right balance between efficiency, fairness, and protection of the public. They have been endorsed by the full committee and are intended to improve the reinstatement process. I thank you for the opportunity to present this petition and also for the opportunity to participate in the OLR Procedure Review Committee. I welcome any additional questions you may have and would be pleased to address them.
Any other justices have any further questions of Director Rothstein?
I have no question, but I echo what Justice Hagedorn said regarding publication, that maybe you should take a look at that. As I recall in reading this, the rule says publication in the county of the office of the attorney, in the county of the residence of the attorney, and publication is by newspaper. Now, I think that our public member, being the former editor of the Chippewa Herald, might want to sing the praises of this provision. I know not that to be accurate, but perhaps nevertheless, in around 2015, both the state legislature and this court addressed the ability to do online publication as opposed to newspaper publication. So perhaps both of those may be checked.
Okay. Thank you very much, Director Rothstein.
Thank you.
The next person I have on my list is Attorney Dean Dietrich.
May it please the court. Good morning, Chief Justice. Good morning, members of the court. My name is Dean Dietrich, and I'm an attorney in Wausau. And I am here today as the past chair of the Committee on Professional Ethics of the State Bar of Wisconsin to address you regarding the petition 19-06 and the position of the Board of Governors of the State Bar of Wisconsin. I think, as indicated in my correspondence, the Board of Governors of the State Bar of Wisconsin welcomes the changes being proposed in 1906. And I thank the committee and I thank this court for considering those changes. The reinstatement process can be a very challenging process for a lawyer who is looking to come back to the practice of law after having lost their license for a period of time. And the current process is quite lengthy. And in many instances, the hearing process before a referee is really not a process that requires a lot of time, yet it is a scheduling process, it is a hearing process, it is a transcript process, and it goes through a great deal of steps to get to the final completion of a decision. I absolutely, and the Board of Governors absolutely welcomes the use of the stipulation process. The OLR does an exhaustive and a very detailed investigation anytime a petition for reinstatement is filed. And that particular investigation does a great deal to bring out what are the relevant considerations for this court to consider ultimately in a reinstatement request. I strongly encourage the court to use the stipulation process as much as possible and be faithful to that, because it does a lot to move the process along and give the opportunity for a lawyer to return to practice. I have participated in a number of reinstatement hearings, and I will just make a couple of comments for you. As I indicated, the reinstatement hearing often is not is as much a pro forma process as it is a very fruitful and meritful process. I believe, although I was not a drafter, I believe the reason that the rules of evidence language is in there is because it is quite common in these reinstatement cases to provide a number of letters of support from individuals. And in order to do that in an expeditious fashion, you don't have the person come and testify and that type of thing. I believe that's the background for that. And the referees accept those letters, understanding their letters written in that capacity. So I speak to very strong support of this process. With regard to the issue of publication, my experiences have been that the publication generally viewed in the Wisconsin Lawyer magazine or the internet publication. And quite often the local news media does not pick up. They'll get the report or the announcement, but not pick that up and necessarily publish it. That's up, of course, to the discretion of the editor, and that's a process that is up to their discretion. So I would be short and brief by indicating the Board of Governors and I truly would support this petition and ask that it be approved.
What's your thought on restitution? I know that's been a concern for Justice Ann Walsh Bradley as she asked Director Rothstein questions about it, and of course she's written about it. What's the Board of Governors' position on that, if they have one?
Chief Justice, the Board of Governors does not have a position on that. We did not discuss that.
Okay.
I feel I am compelled to not comment further. I have just received notice from the court of a briefing schedule on a case that will involve that question.
Okay, very good. And if the Board of Governors hasn't discussed it and you're here as their spokesperson, it would be hard for you to take a position that they haven't considered themselves. So thank you. Any further questions of Attorney Dietrich? Okay, very good.
Thank you.
I see that Keith Saline is in the room, and even though, Mr. Saline, you did not sign up to be a witness, would you come forward for a minute in case the court has some questions to ask of you?
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Keith Saline, the director of the Office of Lawyer Regulation, and I'd be pleased to help you as much as I can.
Okay. Do any members of the court have a question or questions for Mr. Saline? Well, I have one, which is probably why I asked you to come up here. I assume that you have reviewed everything that we have before us and that you're supportive of the petition, correct?
I am supportive of the petition, and I have read everything that was online, I did work with the committee, and I had someone appointed with the Reinstatements Committee from my office to work with them. So we have been involved in a process from the beginning.
Very good. And you heard Judge Patak say that the committee might reconvene to consider restitution. Do you have any position on whether that issue needs reconsideration?
Well, it's apparent just from listening to the questions that it would be helpful for someone to do that. I think the committee is one option. I think the Board of Administrative Oversight would be another option.
That was going to be my follow-up question. Yes. We've just made appointments to the Board of Administrative Oversight.
Wonderful.
You know, as you probably know, getting copies of my letters that went out. And I don't know which would be the better route. Do you have a position on that, whether Judge Patak has to convene his multidisciplinary committee or whether the Board of Administrative Oversight might take a look at it first?
Well, that's a difficult question for the politics of it for a couple
it's
of
okay.
reasons. They're both quite capable. I know that. And, of course, there's always the assignment of work, who has to do work. But I know the board would be happy to do it. And I know Judge Patak has offered that. both of them have a good composition of talented individuals on them. So I'm not concerned that it be one or the other.
And they're both made up of folks who are lawyers and those who are not lawyers as well.
That's true, Chief Justice. There's a higher percentage of non-lawyers on the board, mm-hmm. if that matters.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
With that answer, I think I will vote for you as the next ambassador to the United Nations. It was very diplomatic. Thank you.
Mr. Saline, Mr. Dietrich suggested that the reason perhaps the rules do not provide for the rules of evidence in reinstatement hearings is to accommodate letters of reference in support of the attorney. Do you have any other thoughts on why the rules might not require the rules of evidence to be observed?
Yes, Justice Kelly, a couple of ideas. I agree with Mr. Dietrich, first of all. I think his point is correct. I think that when we look at the reinstatement hearing, we think of it more as an administrative proceeding than we do what I would call a more full due process proceeding when we're looking to take adverse action against it, considering reinstatement. It's not quite the same thing. It helps that it's a little bit more informal for another reason, and that is to provide members of the public who do appear or former clients or other grievants who had come forward in a disciplinary case to be able to make comments informally without taking an oath, without being cross-examined. And so I think it provides a little bit more openness on that question. I think those are the reasons whether they should be continued that way or not.
Thank you.
Do you have any comments on the newspaper follow question that I had? Do you see that as fruitful? Do you see people falling? I'm curious if you have any idea of how much it costs to put money in print publications.
I can help you a little bit there, Justice Agnew, and I wouldn't swear at this point to the specific numbers, but I do have a gut sense of some of these things. I appreciate your question. It varies from newspaper to newspaper what the cost is of an ad. They're generally about the same length. And so I think I have had anywhere from a couple $100 to as much as $600 for an ad. In the course of these proceedings, there are probably a dozen of these at the most during a year. So it's a lot of money. If I were thinking I would take out an ad and put it in a newspaper like that, but in terms of the effect it would have on our budget and funding, it would not be significant in those terms. It's not a significant expense that goes into the reinstatement process. When you review the cost statements, you're going to see it's even a very small portion of the cost statements that OLR provides to you for counsel time, court reporter time, referees time, other things that go into the cost. But I like to save a dollar wherever I can. The newspapers do have online information. I cannot tell you. I haven't looked to see whether they're posting these online. So I don't know the answer to that question. I think that's a good question. When does it result in someone contacting our office? It's not that common, you know, when it's published in the newspaper. I personally was at a hearing where I noticed that two of them actually, where someone came based on the newspaper notice in the paper, and in one occasion, one of them wanted to make comments and wasn't really even related to the underlying misconduct that had occurred when the lawyer had been disciplined, but just had some concerns about the system and the process and wanted to make some statements about what he knew about the impact of that lawyer's behavior on a citizen. And so he was allowed to give an unsworn statement, and the referee considered that. Let's see. I had another thought, but I'm sorry I lost it. And if you have any other questions, I'll be happy.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Judge Patak, do you want to do any cleanup comments before we conclude the hearing? Okay, is there anybody else who'd like to speak on behalf of or in opposition to Rule Petition 1906? Okay, then the hearing is closed, and we will now commence our hearing on Rule Petition 1907. And Attorney Ranney, you are going to be the presenter. Please proceed.
Justice Rogensack, Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Joseph Ranney. I have been called, and I sometimes go by Jay. I am an attorney at the DeWitt Law Firm here in Madison. I am also an professor fellow at Marquette Law School, and I am Marquette Law's designee to the OLR Committee. I'm also the chair of the Confidentiality Subcommittee of the OLR Committee, and I'm here this morning. I would like to give you a brief overview of the various proposals that the committee has made and that the OLR Committee as a whole has approved regarding aspects of confidentiality as they are covered in the disciplinary rules. Basically, the subcommittee has been working at this for several years. We have tried to balance the interests of attorneys in having information that is submitted when they are hauled up on disciplinary proceedings kept confidential. We balance that against the public's interest in having adequate information about possible misconduct by attorneys who have a public trust to their clients and to the public in general. And I want to thank Mark Baker in particular, the public representative to the subcommittee who will be speaking later, for his input on the non-lawyer side of things. And I would also like to add on sections 6 and 7, which I'll be discussing in a minute, we have tried to consider the interests of a third party in this, and that is the interests of the law firms which have hired a lawyer who has been accused of misconduct and put into disciplinary proceedings. So I will just give a very brief overview. We have several proposals that we have made to change the confidentiality provisions, and I would be happy to take questions from the court, of course, as we go along, either at the end of my presentation or as we individual sections or both. So very briefly, the petition consists of a total of 14 sections. The first two sections of the petition concern the statute of limitations. Basically, the current limitations period for a grievant to make a complaint to start the disciplinary process is 10 years. We are proposing two changes. One is to change the period from 10 years to 6 years. That is consistent with most of the other statutes which would apply to the type of behavior which comes under the category of misbehavior that may be potentially subject to the disciplinary process. The other change that we are proposing to make is the question comes up, okay, if you are changing the limitations period to 6 years, the discovery rule has been in effect. We are advocating that that be kept in effect, but the question is, do you report conduct at the earlier or the later times of when the client knows or should know about it? And we are essentially proposing that it be the earlier time. The problem is, if you make the end of the limitations period the later of a time when a client actually knew or should have discovered, that could potentially extend the time that a disciplinary proceeding can be opened to virtually forever, and it's very much in the interest, I think, of the public, of attorneys, and of clients that there be at some point an end of the process.
Why would it be open forever? We use the discovery rule for personal injuries, and it doesn't stay open forever. With a child, it's almost forever. But aside from that, if you have a medical malpractice claim, it's when you knew or should have known, and it's not open forever.
Right, but the problem is, if the rule says the later of when you should have known or you actually knew, discover misconduct 10, 20, 30, 40 years later, that means you could potentially be filing a grievance 20, 30, 40 years after the
conduct. So it's the actual knowledge that you're having trouble with, not knew or should have known. It's not the should have known part that's bothering you. It's, you think when they knew makes actual knowledge one of the markers, and therefore it could go on for a very long time?
Well, what's bothering us, Chief Justice, is whether we use the earlier of the two or the later of the two. The current rule is it's the later of the two, and that could extend the period almost to infinity. We are proposing that the cutoff be at the earlier of the two times, when the person actually knew or the person should have known.
What's the language that provides that it's the later of the two?
Currently, the language is Justice Kelly, it's in SCR 21.18 sub 1. It says right now, within 10 years after the person communicating the information knew or reasonably should have known of this conduct, whichever is later.
That formulation seems to be entirely at odds with the concept of the standard of knew or should have known, right? Because if it's the later of the two, then the should have known just drops out, because the later is always going to be actual knowledge.
Correct. I agree with that.
Okay.
Okay. The next provision is Section 3. That references Section 21.19 of the rules. That is a general section that talks about the general standards of privilege, essentially says that communications are privileged. Now, that particular section does not go into the more detailed question of what information exactly is privileged, when is it privileged, when is it not privileged. We are just making basically a housekeeping change under Section 3 to the general reference to confidentiality. We are proposing to add a section that essentially other sections. What we've tried to do essentially is, as the committee went through the process, we looked at the three generic types of disciplinary proceedings: temporary suspension in a case where you've got some potentially really bad behavior that needs immediate action, suspension for medical reasons, and what I think is the most common type, general misconduct disciplinary proceedings. We felt that the rules, the language was somewhat mixed those up, so we have made an effort to try to treat each of those three categories separately in the rules that deal with them and make it clear within each section what type of confidentiality requirements apply to each type of disciplinary proceeding. So again, Section 3 is just sort of a preliminary to that. I'll be getting into the details of the three sections a little later on in my presentation, but essentially Section 3 just says when you look at the general section, which kind of tees up the idea that there is some kind of confidentiality, we're proposing to have it say, see the later sections which deal with this in more detail. The next part of our petition, Your Honors, is Sections 4 and 5, and that basically is designed to give state trial judges the right to be grievance if they wish to do so. The current rule basically, 22.001, defines who are grievance, and it does not include judges as grievance. We are simply proposing to add a new subsection that says judges may be grievance if they want to be. We received some input on this. The feeling is sometimes lawyers who misbehave are reported for disciplinary proceedings by trial court judges. Typically in the past, the judges have not been treated as grievance, have not been parties to the proceeding. It was felt that trial judges sometimes have, as under their obligation to administer their courts, make things proceed in a fair and just manner, they may have a sufficient interest in a particular attorney's misconduct that they would want to have more of a say in the disciplinary proceedings as things went along, much in the same way that other grievants do. So the subcommittee felt, and the OLR General Committee approved the idea that the definition should be expanded to allow trial judges to be grievance if they want to. They have the option.
That causes me some pause. Of course, I know of instances when a case has started because of a referral of a trial court judge. Is the judge the grievant? Is the court the grievant? It sounds odd to have the court a grievant, huh? The judge is a grievant?
I think that we did not discuss that issue specifically, Justice Bradley, but my personal sense is if at some point it were necessary to label the judge's position formally, I agree with what I think I hear you saying, that it should be considered the court, that particular, the court in front of whom the lawyer's conduct occurred.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, but it raises the question, and since I don't know the answer, sometimes when I don't know the answer, I get rid of the sentence, and I'm wondering if we should make a judge a grievant. Perhaps, I just don't know, because I don't know if the judge is the grievant.
I'm not speaking for the committee, but I will take a bit of a chance here and think out loud. You might have a situation where, say, a lawyer misbehaves in front of, let's say, Milwaukee County Branch 1, to just pick an arbitrary number. You have a particular judge who's in Branch 1 at that point who is incensed enough at the conduct that she wants to B, have the role of a grievant, then she leaves office, is replaced by another judge who is not so interested. I guess at that point the question would arise, should the first judge personally be named or should the branch be named? I'm not sure I have a good answer for you on that.
Thank you.
The next portion of our petition, Your Honors, is Sections 6 and 7. What the committee, subcommittee and the general committee are proposing here is to add a couple of sections that essentially require an attorney who has received the notice from OLR of an investigation to notify her or his law firm that investigation has been proceeding. I know this has attracted some commentary, which we have reviewed. Basically, the subcommittee discussed this in quite a bit of detail, and the subcommittee felt, I think I can correctly say fairly strongly, that this is a situation where you need to consider not just the interest of the lawyer in keeping as much as possible confidential or the public in having appropriate disclosure, but the law firm, if the lawyer is employed by a law firm or by a government agency, I'll call them collectively a firm for the sake of simplicity here, but the firm has an interest as well. Now, there's been some concern, I know, expressed by the Board of Governors that this is something that should be worked out as a private relationship between the law firm and the employer. Basically, if I'm reading the comments correctly, they're saying, well, if the law firm wants to know about disciplinary proceedings against a lawyer, they should negotiate that as a term of employment. I think it's respectfully, it's questionable whether most law firms would look at that closely in the course of everyday business, trying to hire lawyers or make employment arrangements with lawyers. We think it's an important enough issue that it should be inserted in the rules. There are several reasons in the subcommittee's view why law firms should be notified. One is law firms are often affected by the lawyer's conduct. If you have a situation where a lawyer within a law firm has committed some kind of arguable misconduct that's serious enough to attract a letter giving notice of an investigation, this is something that may impact the law firm. If there is potentially serious misconduct there, it may affect the law firm. OLR proceedings are often come from a client who is unhappy with the lawyer. Unhappy clients often also file malpractice lawsuits. If the malpractice lawsuit happens, typically that is going to affect the lawyer's law firm as well as the lawyer herself. Reputationally, it also very much affects the law firm as well as the individual lawyer. If there is a potential issue of misconduct, something that can affect the firm's reputation and the firm's pocketbook, if a malpractice claim is filed, that's something that the firm needs to know about. The other point I'd like to make is people who have responded to the proposal so far have indicated that there is a concern for the individual attorney. There's a risk that the individual attorney will be hauled over the coals by her or his employer and summarily fired. I do not think that is a realistic view of how law practice works.
Well, don't you think it depends a little bit upon whether the person is a senior partner and a matter has been filed against him or her, or the person is a second-year associate? Do you think they both would be treated the same by a law firm having had law experience in a firm? I don't think so.
I can't give you statistics, Chief Justice, but respectfully, my experience has been that is not the case. My experience has been that I think many law firms recognize when OLR initiates an investigation, sometimes the potential is serious, sometimes I don't want to use the word minor, but there are times when it is something that it's not condonable, but it's something that can happen to a lawyer partly out of inadvertency, partly out of carelessness rather than out of evil intent. And my experience has been law firms in those cases are generally of attorneys. They basically say, well, what did you do? Let us talk with you about how you respond to OLR, and let's let's get your position heard, and if there's a problem here, let's do what we can to get to the appropriate resolution. I'd also like to note, I think Mr. Apfel will be speaking to that issue in more detail later,
okay.
But
all
I
right,
wanted to
good.
Give you the subcommittee's thoughts, how that came about.
Can I ask a question before you move off of that?
Yes.
I mean,
Justice Powell.
Well, it has two pieces to it. First of all, I mean, obviously in the criminal realm, we have a presumption of innocence, and I would assume we would have that same thought in the OLR realm, such that any investigation, it doesn't necessarily mean that that conduct will be found to have occurred. So that's the first piece. So why would we subject someone to potential consequences in their practice that may not come to bear? And then along with that fact, there's nothing that bars an attorney when you say they could seek help from their firm and ask for help responding to OLR. Couldn't they do that now if they chose to, as opposed to requiring that they give this kind of notice to their firm?
They can. We think that's best practice, and we think that should be incorporated as best practice into the rules.
What about the first piece of what I said?
Innocent until proven guilty?
Right.
Perhaps I'm too optimistic. I would like to think that most law firm managing partners give the same presumption. I think law firm managing partners generally are experienced lawyers. It's difficult to go through a long-term practice without either being on the receiving end of a letter from OLR or knowing somebody who has received one. I think most senior partners, in my experience at least, are fairly empathetic to those situations. I simply don't think it's as big a risk as the opponents of the proposed change.
But you're counting on them to ensure that as opposed to us as a system giving that presumption before the findings are made.
You also, I think, from a more practical point of view, if you're a managing partner, you have to look at the situation of if you fire somebody and it later turns out there's no cause, unless you have an employment at will agreement, you may be at risk as a not to have done something so bad.
Right, but not even just firing them. I mean, that kind of a cloud coming over someone who doesn't necessarily wind up with the same findings that were initially made could affect career moves. It could affect their work in the firm.
I think turning it around, you also have a situation where you will have young attorneys who get a letter and it's a terrifying thing to get. They very possibly will be terrified. They may not have an idea of where to go for help. I think this rule will help guide them to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, was there anything in particular that prompted this? I mean, is there an example that came up that caused the committee to feel strongly that this is something that's a corrective that's needed?
I don't think any specific examples were discussed. No specific stories were told, Justice Hagedorn. My sense from the discussions within the subcommittee was that people in there had generally had experiences with people in their firms having these situations, and there was a pretty clear consensus. I think I can safely say that it was felt. The idea that an attorney is going to put her or his job at risk by reporting to his firm that he's received a letter from OLR, we did not have any experience of that. Our experience was the other way. Firms are very supportive in general.
I'd like to explore a little bit the interest that this is supposed to protect. So when a letter of referral gets issued, it's addressing a matter in the past, something that has occurred. So this goes to the law firm. What interest is this protecting for the law firm? The incident has already occurred, right? You can't unwind that. So what does this do for the law firm?
It protects two interests, Justice Kelly. One is the law firm's interest in protecting its own reputation, getting to the bottom of what happened so it can see whether it's got a reputational problem, or it's got to defend and try to present, defend and try to show OLR that, or help the attorney show OLR the behavior is not serious and protect its reputation. The other is OLR referrals are potentially at risk for being accompanied by a malpractice claim. If there is a disgruntled client who has filed a complaint that has resulted in a letter, there's a potentially serious problem there. There's, I think, a real question. Is this a time that the firm has to put its malpractice carrier on notice? That's a pretty big red flag.
They certainly might have that obligation if the OLR is requiring they be notified that there's an incident, right?
Yes, or at least
if that requirement is not there and the firm doesn't know, then there's no obligation, obviously, to put their carrier on notice. So this seems like, there are some potentially prudent things that a firm could do in response to this. But all of that presumes there's a basis for the complaint. Right. So in part of my concern is it feels like we're jumping the due process gun here. So we say there is a whiff of a problem, and so everybody now you have to start reacting to that. You are supposed to be taking proactive measures based on that whiff of a potential problem. And I'm really concerned about that. I've seen complaints that have been made to the OLR that they're pretty thin. And I don't know what the numbers are on how many of these eventually play out to imposition of a discipline, but I'm guessing it's less than 100%. And my concern is that when you start this ball rolling down the hill, there's no stopping point for the attorney that's involved, right? So there's reputational hit he's going to get it, even if it turns out there's nothing there. Whatever reputational hit the firm's going to get, they're going to get, even though there's nothing there. And by backing this disclosure up earlier than it is now, it seems that we're creating the opportunity for damage, and I'm not sure that there's a corresponding benefit that we get for that. Because if what we're talking about is, well, there is this allegation, and now everybody's supposed to do something based on that allegation, we run the serious risk of creating more harm than any benefit we might get out of this.
I would respectfully disagree. I think it's important to remember that at this point, it's between the attorney and the firm and OLR. Nothing has been made public yet. I think what it really is for this point is a matter of risk management for the firm. The firm has to think. Also, I might use the word whiff is.
Let me just stop you right there. So one of the interests that you said that this would protect was the firm's reputation. Well, the reputational interest is only going to be an issue if this gets to be public, right?
But I think the firm needs to know what's going on before the public stage so it can plan ahead and say, all right, is this serious enough that it's likely to get to the stage where it becomes public? If I agree with you, many letters ultimately go nowhere, but I think the firm needs to know early on, okay, is this just something it's meritless? We need to respond to OLR, sure, but we don't need to do anything else? Or should they say, oh, boy, this looks really bad, and the files indicate there's some problems here? They need to be able to do that to take care of their risk management issues, know whether they need to report it to their malpractice carrier or not.
Can I ask a question? How would they know it's meritless or not, unless they're going to do their own investigation, right? Because we're just at the beginning at that point. So you're saying, I get what you're saying, you'd like to protect, a firm would like to protect against reputational harm ahead of time, but how are they going to know unless they're doing some kind of internal investigation, which do we really want that occurring at that point for them to be working on their own to try to figure out how much merit there is to the claim?
I think, respectfully, I think both the attorney and the firm need to do that. The way I see it, typically, well, I don't know if there is a typical, but the way, a logical way it would play out is the attorney gets the letter, looks at what the claims are, and at that point, the attorney goes back, looks at the file, tries to reconstruct in her or his mind what she did, and sometimes we'll have to go to the firm and say, can I get that file? There may be other attorneys who worked with that person on the case. She may have to go back to them and say, I'm being told I did this. Do you remember? Tell me what you remember about what happened. I can't quite remember. Things like that. It helps both the firm and the attorney.
And your position is you don't think attorneys would do that otherwise? That this encourages them to do something that they wouldn't do otherwise?
I think many attorneys will do it voluntarily, but I think you may have, for example, some young, panicky, scared attorneys who don't know what to do. You may have other attorneys who, frankly, have done something fairly serious and may want to conceal it from the law firm, something that the law firm should know.
Is there a way to have language that's encouraging as opposed to mandatory?
I'm sorry,
is there a way to put language in the rule that's encouraging as opposed to mandatory? Language that they would get when they get their letter to encourage them to approach the firm. And, I mean, that could be one solution as opposed to mandatory, right?
I think you certainly could put that kind of language in the rule. I think at that recordatory, encouraging language.
Right. Okay, thank you.
So I want to go back to this, the interest that this rule is trying to protect and giving notification to the firm. And you mentioned it's reputational. So what if the firm's decision on how to protect its reputation is to say, this is a bad egg, I'm going to get ahead of this, I'm going to fire him now. And then when it breaks, I'll say, well, that's why we got rid of him. We were proactive in taking care of our clients and protecting reputation, blah, blah, blah. And that's how we do it. Based on this letter of recommendation, we fire you.
Okay, and I'm sorry.
But why would not that be a rational reaction of a law firm to have? If their reputation is what they're trying to protect, why would they not just say, well, this is a bad apple. I don't need the publicity of this guy being at our firm when this comes out. You're gone.
If you have a situation where it's really bad conduct, for example, an attorney stealing funds from a client, stealing funds from the firm, I agree. That's a little bit of a different situation. At that point, I think firing is appropriate. But that's a different situation, for example, from the young lawyer who may have committed a minor offense and is all panicked about it. If you've got an attorney who's stolen money from a client, stolen money from his
alleged,
for example, that's a clear conflict. That firing's probably appropriate there.
Right. So here's my concern. So it, just in the way you referred to this, right? If you've got an attorney who's stolen from a client, well, we don't have that. We have an allegation that he did. Now you give this allegation to the firm, and the firm says, I don't want anything to do with this attorney anymore, because when this comes out, I want to have as much distance as possible between him and me. So based on that allegation, you're gone.
I think two reactions. I would like to think most senior partners would not follow up philosophy. The second.
And what do you base that on?
Pardon?
What do you base that on? I see companies, and not just law firms, I see companies that are scared to death of bad publicity, scared to death. And we see all the time people getting cut from their jobs because of the bad publicity that they bring, right? So why would a law firm not rationally look at this and say, here's some bad publicity that I just don't need? You're done.
Because at the stage when you get the letter, nothing is public yet. What the law firm is doing is not immediately saying, oh, gosh, we're going to have bad publicity for sure. They're evaluating, are we going to have bad publicity up the line? In many cases, they will probably conclude the infraction can be dealt with informally. It's minor, and we don't have to worry about this blowing up in our face.
The alleged infraction. This is my concern. We're at the allegations stage. This would make a world of sense if the misconduct had been found, right? And now you got, obviously the firm's got to know. And based on this thing that you did, you're finished. But this stage, we're dealing with allegations and nothing more, right? And we're expecting law firms to do something in response to that. The whole point of this is so they can manage their reputation and whatever other interests they have to protect. And we want them to take action based on allegations. That's my concern.
I think, Justice Kelly, the best answer I can give to you was based on our discussions within the committee and the experience of the lawyers in there. If it is a, again, what I'll call a minor infraction, our experience has been the vast majority of law firms are not going to do that. They are going to try to help the lawyer. They're going to view it as risk management and evaluation. They're not going to take any drastic action right away. If the infraction is more serious,
it's
then
the alleged infraction.
The alleged infraction. But after an internal investigation, looking at the files, trying to figure out what really happened, they conclude, yes, this was really bad, then yes, they probably will fire him. And at that point, I think that's probably appropriate in most cases.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions on that particular section, or shall I move on?
Oh,
I guess I'll move on.
Please move on.
Okay. All right. The next section of the petition is sections 8 through 10. This is proposed changes to the portions of the temporary suspension rules dealing with confidentiality. Basically, the temporary suspension rules as they stand now provide that all provided in a temporary suspension procedure is confidential until the Supreme Court issues an order to show cause. As the subcommittee reads that rule, it implies, or at least leaves open the possibility, that once the temporary order is issued, everything goes on the public record. The committee discussed at some length, both for this and for some of the other types of disciplinary proceedings, well, is it really appropriate to let every single fact, every single piece of evidence that's come in be cast upon the public record after an order is issued by the Supreme Court? And we ultimately felt that there are some things that it is appropriate to keep confidential after that stage. So we are proposing that the court enact some limited carve-outs. Specifically, the committee is proposing that the court keep confidential the names of the investigator and the grievant, any medical information that came out in the temporary suspension proceedings, except to the extent that the medical information is relevant to the reasons for the temporary suspension. It may be a situation where some medical issue comes up, but it turns out not to be relevant to the disciplinary proceedings. The committee felt medical information that's not related to discipline is sensitive enough that should probably be kept confidential. We tried to balance the public's interest against the attorney's interest there, and as to medical matters unrelated to discipline, we feel that the balance tips in favor of the attorney's interest in privacy. Other things.
So you, just a minute, you do that then in Section 8 by virtue of the exceptions to the disclosure? I think, you know, the new part of 22.21.2 says, except as provided in sub 2M and 3, SCR 2234 and SCR 2240, all papers, files, communications, and proceedings are confidential. So those exception paragraphs are where there are lists of names of witnesses and medical records? Is that how that's accomplished?
I think so, Chief Justice Roggensack. Basically, 22.21 sub 2 says, last sentence, all papers shall be confidential and shall remain confidential until the Supreme Court has issued its order. Our feeling was that kind of leaves open the question, does that mean every single thing becomes public record after that? And right. We basically felt that there, as I've just kind of recited, there's a list of carve-outs we feel it's appropriate that includes names of investigator, names of the grievant, medical information, financial information, again, only to the extent that the financial information has nothing to do with the disciplinary proceedings. There may be information that came up that just doesn't relate to the discipline, and obviously financial information is pretty sensitive stuff.
So it's the name of the grievant is also is not confidential?
We're proposing that that be we're proposing that it be a carve out and that it be kept confidential after the order is issued.
Okay, but early on it wouldn't be confidential in regard to the lawyer, right? Certainly the lawyer has a right to know who's saying he didn't practice properly.
That's true, and there are other rules dealing with that. We are just talking here about what information is made publicly available.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. The next sessions of the petition, we considered the same issue in the context of the here. We are, the way that the rule reads right now is basically that, this is 2234 sub 12, again, all papers shall be confidential until the Supreme Court has issued an order. We are basically proposing here that it's not clear exactly what becomes confidential, what remains confidential after the medical order is issued. We are proposing essentially that the public record include the petition and all papers relating to the petition, but to make clear that nothing else becomes public record at that point. We felt medical proceedings are sensitive enough that the public's information should be limited to medical information that relates to the petition. But if, for example, you have a situation where a medical disability claim is recognized but found to be meritless, we felt, again, the lawyer's interest in keeping health information confidential, in this case, because it has turned out not to be related to any disciplinary issues, we felt it was appropriate to continue to keep it confidential.
What if it were related to a disciplinary matter?
Then, to the extent that it is in the petition and the related materials, to the extent that it forms the basis for the medical suspension order, yes, it should be public.
Okay.
If it's relevant to the disciplinary proceedings, it should be public. If it's not relevant, related to the reasons for discipline, it should remain confidential.
Okay. Thank you.
And the final sections of the confidentiality petition, Your Honors, are sections 13 and 14. This goes to, this goes to Rule 2240. 2240 talks generally about confidentiality procedures, but the purpose of the changes here is to specifically address misconduct disciplinary proceedings, which I understand at least are probably the most common types of disciplinary proceedings. And essentially here, this tracks the concerns that we've addressed in the section with temporary suspensions. We are proposing an amendment of Rule 2240 to make clear that after the Professional Review Committee issues its finding of probable cause to proceed, at that point, information should become public and not before. And again, however, after the information becomes public, after we reach the public stage, we are proposing essentially the same carve-outs that we are proposing for temporary suspension proceedings. One final comment here. We've reviewed the comments of the Board of Governors expressing concern about whether, at what stage should information go from being completely confidential to some kind of public disclosure. As I understand it, the board is basically saying all information should remain confidential until the Supreme Court issues its decision. We are proposing that that be moved back a little bit to the point where the PRC has made a finding of probable cause. I understand due process concerns have been raised. We spent extensive time talking about how do we balance the public's interest in disclosure and knowing what people in a position of public trust are doing versus an attorney's obvious interest in keeping sensitive information sensitive until there's been some kind of determination that this is indeed a serious case. And it was our feeling that the PRC showing of due cause, this is not a situation where the PRC is acting without just impulsively or anything like that. There has been a significant amount of due process already. The investigation process has started. The attorney has had a chance to respond to the questions and the complaints that have been leveled against her or him, and the PRC has, as I understand it, gone through a pretty extensive review of the evidence on both sides. So we feel that although at the PRC stage the final Supreme Court review has yet to come, if you balance confidentiality, the attorney's interest in confidentiality against the public's right to know what people in a position of public trust are doing, there has the lawyer at this point, the PRC stage, has had enough of a hearing. It's clear the charges are serious enough that the public's right to know what is going on is triggered.
You know, we don't treat criminal allegations in that way. In other words, when a criminal complaint is filed against someone, the lawyer can look at the DA's file generally if he requests or do another kind of discovery from the DA, but the public isn't given the DA's file on everything that may have been underneath the decision to file charges. This seems to me lawyers are, in what you're proposing, you know, are really put out there in the public with a lot of information that I bet the public hasn't a clue about how to evaluate. Why do that?
I am not a criminal lawyer, Chief Justice Reigensacks, but I will go out on a little bit of a limb here and suggest to you respectfully maybe a better analogy is, for example, a grand jury indictment. At this point, they haven't been an accused has not been convicted, but at that point, the fact that there's been an indictment is, as I understand it, public information. So I think they recognize some interest in publicly disclosing those proceedings before an actual conviction.
Okay, well, grand jury,
that's analogous to what we're proposing.
Grand juries are federal process. We use John Doe's here, and John Doe's are secret in Wisconsin. So our process is just a little bit different into how we handle those kinds of matters. I guess I don't understand why push it back. Why push it back before the Supreme Court's had a chance to look at it? Why put the authority to inform the public on the PRC? I don't understand what's the rationale for that.
I think the rationale is the balancing the interests of people, potential clients of the lawyer other than the grievant, for example, people who have other pending matters with the lawyer, people who may be thinking about hiring the lawyer. The committee's feeling was that at the PRC stage, there has been enough of a hearing, and it's clear it's serious enough that those people have the right to know that their attorney is or the person they're thinking of hiring is engaging in some
alleged to have engaged. Let's make sure we keep this straight, right? These are allegations. They're not proven conduct. And what you're suggesting is this should be made public information so that others can respond to this attorney and make decisions about this attorney based on allegations, right?
Correct. Allegations that have reached a stage where a committee, after hearing evidence, has found probable cause.
Found probable cause. Probable cause is an extraordinarily low bar. And just that's it. We say, now, public, you make a decision about whether you're going to fire an attorney, fire someone from their job, interact with them differently because of probable cause. Let me put it this way. Is the justification for disclosing the information to the public, is the justification for that the same as the reason we disclose information to the public about criminal proceedings?
I don't think so. Justice Kelly, attorneys, unlike people accused of crimes, are figures of public trust. The public, I think, has a greater right to know when somebody who is in a position of public trust has been the subject of a preliminary finding of highly problematic. So short answer to your question is I don't think that's a good analogy.
Okay. So we want the public to treat the attorney differently once the finding of probable cause has come out.
We want them to have the information so that they can make up their own mind whether they want to proceed to deal with the attorney.
So if someone comes out and says, you know, Attorney X was stealing my money that I had in trust with him, yeah? What person in their right mind is going to hire that attorney when that allegation comes out? The answer is, no one who knows that information will hire him. And let's say we go through this whole dragged-out process, and a year later we find out that this person that made the allegation was just making it up. They're just angry at their attorney. Now, we've released this, and we've maximized the harm to the attorney based on an allegation that didn't play out. Do we bear any responsibility in that?
I think the question that would raise in my mind, and I don't have an answer for you, is that raises the question, say that determination of probable cause is a low bar. I do not know how many cases in which a probable cause finding is made go on to result in an imposition of discipline and essentially a ratification by the Supreme Court of the PRC's findings. If it is high, and my gut is it is pretty high, although I can't tell you that, then I think that allays a lot of your due process concerns. If the Supreme Court disagrees with the PRC a lot, then honestly, yeah, I think your point makes sense.
Go ahead.
Wouldn't it be better to try to move the procedure forward more quickly to Supreme Court review rather than release the information more quickly?
I suppose that would be a solution, Chief Justice Ragansack, if it can be done.
Okay, thank you.
That's one possibility.
Yeah, Justice Bradley.
Thank you. In his letter to us, Attorney Dietrich notes that at the time of a cause to proceed determination being made, the respondent attorney has had no opportunity to appear before the PRC. Do you agree with that statement?
I honestly do not.
Thank you.
Is there much of a difference in pushing this matter forward, as it has been characterized? That is, the amendment recommends that information be made public upon the determination of the preliminary review committee finding cause to proceed. I don't know the numbers, but my sense is, then it's sent to the director, and the director, just like before it was submitted to the PRC, Preliminary Review Committee, the director has discretion to do diversion and do other things. After there is found cause to proceed, it's sent to the director. I would guess in a high percentage of cases, the director then files the complaint based on the cause determination. So functionally, there may not be much of a difference at all. You may not be pushing it forward because, of course, our current law is once a complaint is filed, then it's public information. So could you speak to that? Is functionally what you're asking really much of a difference?
If I hear you correctly, you're addressing the concern that essentially the opportunity for an attorney who's in proceedings to talk with OLR and try to continue to resolve the matter short of a final hearing will be jeopardized by information being made public at the PRC stage. Have I understood your question correctly?
No, you attribute to me much more than I deserve.
Sorry.
All I'm saying is this, that it seems to me a high percentage of cases upon which a cause to proceed has been found that then go to the director. The director files a complaint. Check me on that statistic. I'm not sure that's correct, my assumption. But if it is correct, there's not much functional difference, is there, in terms of timing of when information becomes public? Because our current rule provides that the information is public upon filing of the complaint by the director.
Okay. I guess as to the question of how many go forward at that point, I would defer to Mr. Saleen. I don't know the answer to that one. And I think to your point of, well, doesn't doesn't essentially the proceeding accelerate forward to a final Supreme Court hearing? I do not know what the delay is. Chief Justice Roggensack indicated that if we can do it quickly, there really wouldn't be much real-world difference between disclosing at the PRC stage and disclosing at the Supreme Court order stage, but that does depend on how long it takes your honors to get from a PRC determination and a filing to a final decision.
Yes, but we're just talking, I'm focusing on the filing of the complaint. That's what now, under our current rule, makes things public.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
That's it. Right. And I'm positing for further exploration that in many cases, perhaps most cases, that functionally there's not much of a difference. Because in many cases, maybe most cases, a complaint is filed after the PRC finds cause to proceed.
I don't know. I would totally have to defer to Mr. Saline on that one. All right. Well, I think I've covered all of the sections of our petition, Your Honors. Thank you for your time. Again, I would say the committee has tried to do very, very broad overview here, has tried to do two things: clean up some of the cross references in the confidentiality provisions, make it clear what provisions apply to temporary suspensions, medical suspensions, and misconduct proceedings, so that attorneys and judges alike have more clear guidance as to what applies to what. And we have also, without rehashing all the various things we've talked about here, we have tried to achieve a balance of interest between the public's right to know about problematic behavior by attorneys as officers who have a public trust, an attorney's very understandable right to have a chance to defend themselves and not have confidential information come out until the proceedings are well along, and on the one provision, the law firm's interest in trying to help its attorneys in some cases know when there is a behavior that's bad enough that it creates a conflict to which something has to be done about immediately, and just generally managing risk, both exposure to itself from bad behavior by its lawyers and a chance to help young lawyers who may get a letter for something that turns out to be unfounded or relatively minor, and frankly they need some help. And again, in the committee's experience in those situations, law firms are almost always supportive of managing people, try to help young lawyers, not fire them. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Attorney Dietrich, I think you're next on the hit parade.
Thank you, Chief Justice and members of the court. I would like to just make a couple of comments and then answer any questions you may have. I have submitted to you a document that spoke to the concerns of the Board of Governors of the State Bar after their review of the petition. And I have told you, and I speak in a capacity as the past chair of the Committee on Professional Ethics of the State Bar. As a practitioner, I have also submitted a letter to you in which I've raised and discussed some of the issues that are brought forward by Petition 1907. I hear from the presentations and questions of the court that I think you see the issues that were raised, and so that's why I said I'd be very pleased to answer questions you may have regarding the elements of this petition. If I could first speak briefly to the proposal that there be notice given by the lawyer to the employer. I have over the years advised law firms regarding what they can and cannot or should not do when they become aware of a matter involving a lawyer in their law firm. And first I will say, this isn't true across the board, but I think I have a lot of experience to suggest that lawyers are not the best employment lawyers in groups that we face. And I will tell you for sure that the circumstances when a managing partner in a law firm becomes aware that a grievance has been filed or something has occurred involving one of the attorneys, they may contact counsel and decide not to proceed with a summary termination. But the very likely next step is going to be they're going to be looking to take certain cases away from that lawyer for particularly what they would consider to be the more important clients of the firm. Now, will that always stay that way? Will they get the confidence back from the if the matter is dismissed summarily? I think we all know human nature has a lot of weight in that consideration. So my concern and the concern that we've expressed in our materials is giving that notice before really nothing has been done other than a conclusion reached by the Office of Lawyer Regulation that, well, it looks like there's something here that warrants a further investigation. With regard to the confidentiality provisions in this petition, particularly 13 and 14, I would first respond, Justice J.R. Bradley, that I don't think it's just my clients that are excluded from being able to appear before a preliminary review committee, but it could be. Maybe they just don't want me to go there. I don't know. But there's an opportunity to submit a written document in response to the preliminary review committee, the investigative report. That written document goes to the preliminary review committee as part of the huge submittal. But there is no opportunity to appear in person. And sometimes you don't get the chance to submit the written statement. The second point that I want to make with regard to this particular part of the petition, and it may be a little bit of a challenge for you to do this, but I think there's a statement on page 10 of the submittal from the committee, and I'll simply read it. Current discussion, the current rule. After the investigation, the director may obtain the attorney's consent to a reprimand or submit the results of the investigation to the preliminary review committee. If the preliminary review committee finds that the director has established cause to proceed, it issues a written cause to proceed determination, and the director may file a complaint with the court alleging misconduct. And I spoke to this in my letter. In the past rulings of this court and orders of this court, you have looked to give some discretion to the Office of Lawyer Regulation and the Executive Director when that final decision is made to file a complaint. If now that decision by the Preliminary Review Committee is published, And if you aren't aware, where often this gets published is in the Milwaukee, in the Wisconsin law, the day after a complaint is filed. And one of the most challenging things in the representation of a respondent is how do you respond to an article in the Wisconsin Law Journal that identifies the misconduct when you've not had an opportunity to even submit your answer to the complaint. So if you think that, you know, that this all gets handled through the complaint and answer process, believe me, the first and sometimes the most challenging decision is what do you do with the media the day after a complaint is filed? And that's when it gets out, and that's when the media picks it up, and that's when it's in the local newspaper, if it's caught up in the local newspaper. And, again, you're just going to be moving that to an earlier time when even the OLR director may not have exercised his discretion on how he's going to proceed. So I think that the current system as it exists, I would love to argue that we should change the current system to not have it become public, but that's not realistic either. So I think that the current system is what should continue for purposes of the confidentiality. Chief Justice, again, I think the questions have articulated some of the points that I want to make, and I don't want to hold the court any longer. Is there any questions I could answer?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Dietrich.
Thank you.
Mr. Baker.
Good morning. My name is Mark Baker, and I serve as the public representative on the OLR Procedure Review Committee. I was privileged to serve on the committee with a number of distinguished attorneys, law school professors, and, of course, Judge Gerald Patette. Being the only member who had not attended law school nor practiced law, I felt a strong responsibility to represent the public's interest in the OLR process. I'm here today to voice my support for the recommendations now before the Supreme Court to improve and to streamline the OLR process. First, some background. After graduating with a journalism degree in the 1970s, I spent nearly 3.5 decades in the newspaper industry, working both at weekly and daily newspapers. Starting at the bottom as a beat reporter, I worked my way up to be an editor and later on group publisher of a number of daily print and online publications in western Wisconsin. During my tenure, I served on the Associated Press Managing Editors Board, as well as the Wisconsin Newspaper Association Board, including terms as Vice President and President. Shortly after finishing my term as WNA President, then Chief Justice Abramson asked me to serve as a public member on the Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners, which I did for 6 years. We spent a good deal of time during that period tackling character and fitness issues at the front end of the licensing system. That's why when Chief Justice Robinsack asked me to serve on a committee to review the OLR process and make recommendations to improve it, I agreed. After 3 years of work, I believe the committee's recommendations are reasonable, well thought out, and important for both the protection of the public and the oversight of the legal profession. My interest in the criminal justice system developed earlier in my career as I spent countless hours covering all aspects of it from my publications. I witnessed how the system handled routine as well as challenging issues, be they criminal or civil, and how most court officials did their best to ensure a fair and impartial process for all. I also learned that the criminal justice system is composed of individuals of a variety of interests and talents. As such, it needs clear and concise rules of conduct, along with constant monitoring to ensure that it delivers on its fundamental purpose. Like any occupation, the legal profession has a lot of good apples and a few bad ones in its barrel. That's why I am a strong advocate for openness in the OLR process, because it provides the foundation necessary for average citizens to trust in the system. Not everyone sees it that way. I remember when I was a rookie reporter and walked into my first sheriff's department and asked if I could see the jail log, and the receptionist behind the glass said, "Well, I'm sorry, you can't see it until the sheriff approves it." And I said, "Well, how about the accident report?" "So, same thing. You can't see those until the sheriff reviews them first and gives his okay." And 40 years ago, that's how it was in a lot of small towns. But with my association, we did challenge that, and the courts affirmed our right to access public records without the sheriff's prior review or without his approval. Once public records are created, they belong to the public, not to an elected official, unless authorities can point to a specific statute that prohibits release. It is their duty to provide these records in a timely manner to anyone. That's why I'm speaking in favor of a key proposal in the process of handling OLR complaints. Currently, when a consumer of legal services feels he or she may have been harmed by unethical behavior by an attorney, he or she can file a complaint with the OLR. However, it's easy for that complaint to fall into a dark hole and disappear for months and months and months while the process works its course. It's possible that the consumer who has been harmed, as well as other potential clients, are left in the dark until the case arrives at the doorstep of the Supreme Court for final disposition. Our committee believes that the OLR process should be comparable to the existing court system. When the state formally acts against an individual, the matter becomes public. If a member of the public is arrested for alleged drunk driving, that information is available to the public. If a member of the public is jailed for alleged assault and battery or domestic violence, that information is available to the public. If a treasurer of a youth sports organization is accused of stealing funds from that organization, the details are available as soon as a criminal complaint is filed. Each of these occurred during my tenure in the news business. Those charged, though presumed innocent, had to deal with the fact that public knowledge of their alleged actions could affect their families, their jobs, and their reputation within the community. The same should hold true with a complaint against an attorney. OLR staff can investigate a complaint, and if it finds that there's nothing of substance, the file is closed, nothing comes of it. If the OLR finds cause to proceed to a formal hearing, the information should be available to the public at that time. Consumers naturally assume when they seek legal services that their attorney is honest and competent. Consumers need to know if an attorney is facing allegations of misconduct. There was a great deal of discussion of the unfairness a complaint might have on an attorney's reputation and their livelihood. And we believe that the OLR vetting process would filter out most false accusations before they reach a determination that there is cause to proceed. The OLR process has two objectives. First, to protect attorneys from false accusations, but second, to protect the public from unscrupulous professionals who either failed in their duty or intentionally harmed someone by their actions. That's why I believe the committee's recommendations on the confidentiality petition is fair to both attorneys and to the general public. The state should have as great an interest in protecting an unsuspecting public as a licensed attorney who may be causing harm. The process must be balanced so that it is not overly favorable to one side at the expense of the other. Thank you for giving me the time to appear before you today. It's been a pleasure, and I will take any questions, although I know I've read more than I commented.
You. Any questions from the court? Thank you very much. Thanks for taking the time to appear, and thank you for serving on our committee.
Here's a drilling down question. Do I recall that any of your family members are members of the legal profession?
Yes, I have a sister who's an attorney.
Yeah, I was just wondering if your relatives have ever appeared before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, now that you have.
They have not. My sister is a licensed attorney in Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
Maybe. But we've had many a discussion about this, and she has... And I understand most attorneys are very concerned about the effect on their reputation and on their livelihood, and I understand that. But I guess I saw my role within the committee to say, you know, the general public has to deal with this all the time, and they have to deal with allegations that may or may not be true. And yeah, I'm not saying that that's a terrible thing. That's the way our system is. But to have trust in that system, I think that the court really needs to take a look and say, yes, we want there to be a fair process for attorneys, but we have to remember the responsibility to the public as well. And most attorneys are good, and they're different, and they're passionate. But there are some out there that I think the public needs to be protected from.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Apta.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice Ragansack, other members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Mike Apfeld, and I'm appearing in support of the petition and speaking in particular to notification of an attorney's employer law firm. Having heard the discussion so far, I would like to try to reframe the discussion, to be quite honest. So far, the discussion seems to be framed in terms of the lawyer's rights versus the law firm's rights. I would suggest that's not the principal purpose of this notification statute. If you need to frame it in terms of sets of rights, it's the accused lawyer's rights versus the rights of potentially other clients of the firm and of this lawyer who may well be affected by similar actions or similar conditions that are unknown to the law firm and undiscoverable by the law firm until problems arise. That's the underlying purpose of this. And to the extent it benefits or may protect the law firm, that protection is only secondary. The purpose is to give the law firm early warning of a potential problem and allow the law firm to conduct its own investigation and determine whether or not something needs to be done. I think that there is a possibility that there are firms out there that may react irrationally and without investigation, but I would like to believe that neither our firm nor the majority of other firms would react in that fashion. I would also point out...
Well, this is part of my concern.
Yes.
I suspected that the import of this was not so much that the law firm could protect its reputational interests, so much as the intent is that the firm and others would take actions based on these allegations, right? And the actions being either, and it could be an internal investigation to figure out what happened, or it might be, as you say, potential clients. They need to know so they can make their choices. And so what this rule is advocating is that based on allegations alone, this attorney would be facing repercussions because a potential client, when this gets out in the public, is going to go somewhere else, right? I mean, that is almost a given. We have more than enough attorneys in the state to handle any given kind of matter, that if you have one attorney who's been accused of wrongdoing, you're going to go to some other attorney that's not, right?
Well, Your Honor has taken a lot of steps forward in time, and
I'm taking the steps you proposed. So when this information is given, you suggested that this is information that's important to get out there so that prospective clients can make decisions.
If I phrased it that way, then I phrased it incorrectly. It is important to give one person, the supervising attorney at the law firm, information so that that person will first make a determination whether any investigation is truly conducted, because frankly, some not well-founded and not colorable on their face. But to allow that supervising attorney to determine whether investigation is necessary, and if so, what are the appropriate steps. That may never result in anything remotely resembling discipline or notification of other clients, and much less public notification. Those are all steps far down the road and only contingent upon upon a determination that there's any real reason for it. I mean, your Honor has been scrupulous about reminding other speakers here to speak of mere accusations and not of actual guilt, and I take that quite seriously in my capacity in my law firm.
So let's follow the logical progression of events out. The rule proposes two different notification pathways, right? So one is when there is a specific individual in a supervisory capacity over this person.
Yes.
And the other situation is when there's not.
Yes.
So when there is a supervisor, the information goes to that supervisor. When there's not, it goes to all the partners in the firm, right?
Yes, if the firm has not fought to nominate a managing partner or something
like
that.
The rule says all the partners and shareholders.
Yes. Yeah.
So, excuse me. So let's say this is, there is one individual who supervises, and he gets the information. What do you think that supervising attorney is going to do with that information vis-a-vis all of his partners?
Well, I don't know that there is any presumption. I think that that supervising attorney, and or the loss prevention partner, if that's the appropriate person, would conduct an initial interview with the lawyer itself, himself or herself, and then based on that, decide what to do. I don't think that a general notification can be assumed.
Let's say it's a partnership. Mm-hmm. And in a partnership, each attorney bears, each partner bears a fiduciary duty to the others. Yeah?
Yes, although often, modified by agreements.
Okay. I'm willing to guess there aren't many agreements that address this kind of situation. So that partner has no fiduciary obligation to this non-partner. So wouldn't the natural cause, natural order of events indicate that either way, all the partners are going to know about this?
No, not necessarily. Assuming that there is a managing partner, the managing partner undoubtedly has some discretion within his managerial responsibilities to determine what steps are necessary and in what order. And, the accused attorney might be an associate, might also be a partner.
And if he is a partner, then all the partners are going to know, right? Because the rule says that notification has to be given to all the partners.
Not necessarily.
Well, where's the exception?
Well, if we are operating under the assumption that there is no supervising partner, yes, it must be given to all partners.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Do you anticipate this rule being implemented or actualized in a different fashion, whether it's a large law firm or whether it's one of the many 2, 3, 4 member law firms, small law firms throughout Wisconsin? Does it play out differently?
Insofar as they would have different management structures, it probably would. But I don't think that there is necessarily any incentive for attorneys to look for any unfounded excuse to excise, to boot attorneys out of their firm, whether, other partners or shareholders or associates. Frankly, most attorneys accused, who are the subject of agreements, I would like to believe will automatically self-report because they seek the support of their fellow, of their firm, and they seek counsel and advice. But that is not always the case. I believe, Justice Kelly, you asked if there was any incident or motivating factor behind this rule. And to the extent that, I might have been a part of this rule, the motivating impetus for this, in combination with a lot of experience, was actually the study that came out about 2 years ago that was co-sponsored by the State Bar and the Betty Ford Hazelden Foundation on attorney alcohol and substance abuse. And if you are familiar with that, and to generalize, it basically came to the conclusion that far over 20% of our profession had serious alcohol abuse problems, and that it might be even worse than that, depending on how you interpret it. I can also tell you that there are two things, or three things perhaps, about that I would observe about lawyers who have such problems. The first thing is I believe that they probably account for a greater than average or greater than proportionate share of the grievances that ultimately come before the court. I would also tell you, or at least submit to you, that one problem a mistake that results from that problem is probably not isolated. There are probably others yet to be discovered. And I will also tell you that attorneys suffering under such a problem are masters at concealing such a problem. From a managerial standpoint, discovery, finding out that there is a problem, is a sine qua non, a prerequisite for attempting to cure the problem, not only for the benefit of the attorney, but for seeking to discover whatever else might have happened and has yet come to light with other attorneys, or perhaps prevented from happening in the future. And, we are not able to independently discover those grievances. This is the only mechanism by which a grievance can be brought to our attention early in the process. And in this pursuit, earlier is better. It is far better for the firm to know earlier. And with all due respect to OLR and the courts, the firm is in a far better position to actually discover what's going on and to do so quickly. So it's very difficult to put numbers on this. But I would suggest that if we are balancing rights and interests in this case, you are balancing the attorney's proposed right to be protected from the potential irrational reaction of his or her law firm versus the rights of other unknown potential client victims of the same sorts of problems. And I'll admit to you, I can't quantify that. Certainly on the one end, I would like to believe that most law firms would react rationally and would support their attorneys. And on the other hand, I do believe that there is a significant opportunity here to prevent problems. But I can't quantify it for you.
Yeah,
but
I would agree with you 100% if we were talking about problems. But we're talking about alleged problems.
Absolutely. And if I slipped up, Your Honor, it's simply because I'm pressed for time and I'm trying to eliminate words. But again, the assumption is, at least my assumption is, that the report will result in a rational investigation.
Counsel, just a couple of quick questions related. Obviously, we're in our function where we are doing some policy work here, unlike when we decide cases. So it brings a question of government power. My default in these sorts of things is I'm a bit less interested and a bit worried about when government gets involved in new types of things. That often causes collateral consequences that may not be foreseen or known, and has the potential to do some harm that, again, may or may not be foreseen. So you're asking us to step into the relationship between a law firm and those who work at a law firm in what seems like a unique way. And I wonder if that intrusion into maybe the default situation, if you think there ought to be any caution or if there's a warrant for that, I understand your position there. And this is a related question. I suppose some of that could be alleviated by the fact that maybe we have lots of knowledge about how this stuff plays out. Did the committee look at whether any other states do such a thing? Do we have any other evidence of this being in place in other places that might alleviate some of the concerns that have been expressed?
Addressing your second question first, Your Honor, I candidly do not know. And perhaps others on the committee do, but I don't know whether or not other states have taken this. With regard to the first aspect of your question, I would resist the characterization of this as intrusion into the employer-employee relationship. It's a notice requirement. And there are lots of notice requirements in the law. There are notice requirements in contracts. There are, you know, notice requirements imposed by statute, notice requirements imposed by the common law. You know, certain things you're expected to, you know, disclose to your contracting partner at certain points of the relationship. But I'd also point out that the practice of law is, in essence, and has always been, a regulated industry. So, I mean, this is, at most, I would suggest, an incremental change. And to the extent that it is a change in which we cannot predict the effects with mathematical certainty, well, I'll confess that's true. We can't. But I do know that, you know, there have been a number of instances of attorneys, you know, who have committed, you know, serial instances, violations of the rule, you know, that might have been prevented or ameliorated if discovered previously by their employers.
Any other questions from the court? Well, thank you very much. Thank you for all your assistance in this regard. Let's see, Attorney Schwarzenbart, I think you're next on my hit parade.
Thank you, Chief Justice Rogensack, members of the court. My name is Paul Schwarzenbart. I'm an attorney practicing in Madison. I served on the OLR Review Committee. I was the chair of one of the subcommittees, not the subcommittee here led by Attorney Rainey that looked at Petition 1907, but that I am here to speak in support of that, in part because the subcommittee I chaired, on which Attorney Abfeld served ably, we had started looking independently at the issue of specifically whether allegations of misconduct should be reported to law firms and at what point. And that's what I'm here to speak for you before you today. Judge Pitak alluded to the fact that I would be speaking to an anecdote, and before I get into these sometimes unfairly derided anecdotal evidence, I do have some other comments that have to touch upon issues that have been addressed by the court with other speakers here today. And I come to you today speaking with 35 years of experience working on prosecution of disciplinary cases. I started in 1984 as an associate assisting an attorney prosecuting several cases. In 1989, I became a member of the panel of outside prosecutors for the former Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility. And when the OLR was created in the year 2000, I became one of the retained attorneys prosecuting cases on behalf of the OLR. I've handled a few reinstatement cases, at least one that went to a hearing, so I'm familiar with all aspects of this process. First of all, probably going in reverse order, Justice Hagedorn had asked whether there are other states that have addressed the issue of notification to law firms. I think there's two examples to look to. Number one is probably the extreme example, which our committee was not recommending, which is the example in the state of Oregon, where the entire process is open to the public from the get-go, from the filing of a grievance. The state of Alabama does have a rule that has provided for notification of law firms. We looked at that, but again, Attorney Rainey's subcommittee was the one handling that, so we did not, I don't believe it. The rule that we're proposing here today was specifically modeled on the Alabama example, but there is at least that one that we were made aware of where another state has adopted this type of rule. Secondly, regarding the fact that the notification would be made based on allegations, I think it's important to clarify the three-step process at the OLR. There is an intake phase at which, and if Director Celine can perhaps help me out with the exact statistics on this, but I would guess somewhere more than 90% of grievances are weeded out at the intake stage before they go to the investigation stage. The proposal here is not that the firms would be notified at the intake stage of a grievance being filed, but only after the letter was sent out from the OLR, after approval by the director, that there should be a formal investigation undertaken. So most of the, and hopefully all of the groundless, the totally groundless grievances at least, will have been weeded out at intake. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. I think I would echo the comments of Mr. Baker, who compares this process to the criminal process in the sense that the filing of criminal charges is something that is made known to the public. It's publicized.
But there's a specific reason that information is given to the public, right? This is not. This is actually not about public protection. It's about the protection of the defendant to make sure that he is not subjected to any secret prosecution or trial, right? That's why we have that information public.
Well, and I think, it does echo a concern that could be made here, which is the OLR process should never be a secret court, and nobody is advocating that it be made a secret court. But the processes that lead up to the issuing of a cause to proceed determination by the preliminary review committee is in some sense the equivalent of a criminal indictment being brought down publicly.
Has there ever been a complaint by an attorney that the OLR process is not sufficiently public?
I don't know that I'm aware of a complaint being made by an attorney that it's not sufficiently public. I did want to speak to one question raised by Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, questioning what is the difference between what is being proposed by this committee as opposed to the current rule, particularly under Supreme Court Rule 22.40, because I actually did provide some pushback to the committee on that. The current status is that the filing of a complaint triggers public disclosure of disciplinary charges being filed against an attorney based on a grievance. If the proposal is accepted, basically it makes a difference of about 2 weeks, because it's about a two-week span of time between a meeting of the PRC where cause to proceed is determined and the time when disciplinary charges are filed. I heard Attorney Dietrich, suggest that he didn't allude specifically to a two-week period of time, but he did allude to the possibility that the director has discretion after a determination of cause to proceed to resolve the matter on a basis that would not involve the filing of public charges. I would submit that that is a rare occasion, and if in fact there is going to be a consent public reprimand or a diversion, that those types of dispositions occur long before a matter is taken to the PRC. So to answer the question, basically it's about a two-week difference. Is there a hypothetical possibility that the PRC finds cause to proceed on charges, but the matter never gets filed as a public complaint? Hypothetically, that's a possibility, but I think in the real world that's highly unlikely to happen.
So if it's only 2 weeks, why change the rule?
Well, that was a question I raised with the committee, and after much discussion, I did not feel passionate enough about it to issue a dissenting statement on it, but that was a discussion that we had. And I think the consensus that was basically reached, and I don't want to speak for other people who felt more passionately about it than I did, was that at that point you've had somebody objectively outside of just the OLR looking at the investigative report and finding, yes, there's something here that merits prosecution. Why are we waiting the additional 2 weeks? It might make a difference to somebody who is thinking about hiring a lawyer in those 2 weeks, that maybe they would want to know that, hey, I'm hiring a lawyer who may lose his license before he's done being able to handle my case.
And what about Attorney Dietrich's comments about the inability of the individual still to respond to the media, which is what the response will be, whereas if you wait the 2 weeks, they'll have whatever they say will then potentially be able to be said to the media.
Well, I think that raises another question about the process here. I think there seems to be an assumption that there will be some sort of public release or like a PR statement of on the date of the preliminary review committee meeting that, you know, we found cause to proceed against these people. That's not, I think, what the rule says. I think what the rule says is that the OLR can release it to the public. It's not proposing a mechanism for same-day release of information. They're simply saying it can be released. One other thing I'd like to address, just so there's no question about it, but there seems to be possibly some confusion about the type of public, what information is public under Supreme Court Rule 2240 and possibly confusing that with the Open Records Act. The rule is not proposing that the files of the OLR be opened up and subjected to the Wisconsin Public Records Statute. That's not what is proposed. That has not been the practice. What is public under the current rule, what's public is the complaint that is filed with the Supreme Court and basically everything that is filed in that case after that point. Ironically, what it means is that once charges are filed with the court, even if the final disposition is a private reprimand, those files have been made public. It's ironic. There is not a published opinion that appears in the Wisconsin reports for a private reprimand. I don't think you can find those on Westlaw, although there at least was a time when one could find private reprimands on the court's own website. I think I pointed that out to the court about 10 years ago when I saw that happen. I don't know if that's been fixed or not. But again, the rule is not proposing that the prosecutor's file be subjected to the Public Records Act. I believe under this court's case law, district attorney files are not subject to the Open Records Act, and I don't believe generally that the court files, at least the personal files of circuit court judges, are not open records. It's what's filed in public is what becomes public. With those preliminary comments, I do want to get to the anecdote that has stuck with me for 30 years that addresses notification to a law firm. I was appointed an OLR or a BAPR prosecutor back in, I think it was 1989. I remember the first two cases I was assigned, and one of them was a case seeking revocation. And what it involved was an attorney who had his own law firm, and probably because he was not successful making a living as a solo practitioner, had joined a firm doing collection work. The alleged misconduct is something that happened in his prior practice when he was a solo practitioner. Complaint was filed. There was a public hearing. Former Governor Doyle was actually the referee on the case. And there was a finding, a decision by the court to revoke the attorney's license. I don't recall at exactly what stage it was, but I remember distinctly receiving a phone call from the managing partner of this firm, who started out the phone call outraged because the firm was blindsided. They were the last people to know of this complaint that had been filed against their employee. I continued the conversation with the attorney, and what it transpired was it wasn't that he was outraged that they were first finding out about this now because this was somebody they had to get out of the firm. He was calling me because the attorney had walked into his office, turned in his keys, and they were concerned about his mental health. He indicated to me he was concerned the attorney was suicidal, and he wished that that they had known about this earlier so that they could have done something to make this easier. That's one example. I wouldn't suggest that there's any pattern that's going to be followed in these types of cases, but that has stuck with me for 30 years, that this partner called me to express the concerns he had about the mental health of this attorney. Thank you, Your Honors. I'd entertain any questions that you might have.
Any questions? Well, thank you very much, and
thank you
for taking the time to come. Now, I have to ask an indulgence of my colleagues. I would like to finish this hearing, but we need, at least I think we need, to hear from Keith Saleen for a few minutes, and then Attorney Ranney may want to give some follow-up since he was the presenter. I think we could do that in 20 minutes, but I know sometimes you all have appointments at 12 or 10 after 12, and you can't do that. I'd like to finish. Otherwise, we can bring everybody back at 1:30 because we will reconvene at 1:30. Rather than in closed conference, we can convene out here.
Good.
Is it okay with you all to continue? Mm-hmm. Okay, then that's what we will do. Mr. Saleen, if you could come forward, maybe help us with a couple of facts and circumstances, and then Attorney Ranney, you also. And we'll try to give you each about 10 minutes, and then we're going to conclude this hearing. Okay?
May it please the Court, I'm Keith Saleen, the Director of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. How can I help you?
Are you supportive of everything in this petition?
This is a petition where OLR has really not taken a position on any of the specific proposals. I was on the subcommittee with confidentiality. I'm comfortable with what they want to do, and I'm comfortable where we are. And so I didn't feel strongly enough about any of it to take a position.
Okay.
Are there ever situations where the, you know, there's the goes through the, we got the intake phase and the PRC, and then you issue a letter, it sounds like, with your approval. What's the percentage of complaints that come in that go through those stages? And is there ever any daylight between, you know, the PRC saying go forward and you saying no?
Once we get to the preliminary review committee finding of cause to proceed, there are several things that have happened, and then there's a period of time when we are preparing to resolve it in one of several ways. Before that time, as Attorney Schwarzenbart told you, 90% of them are closed at intake, and that percentage has been declining over the last 2 years. It has not stopped declining, but I never know when it's going to turn or be level. And so there are a lot of things that we know don't require any response from our office, or we are able to handle some things informally that are minor concerns and resolve that way. The formal investigation that would start then goes with a notice, and when we issue that notice, I have looked at the intake file, I've made a decision to refer it for formal investigation, signed it to an investigator to start it. When they are done, about 60% of them are going to be closed because they are dismissed or diverted or they result in a private reprimand at that point. Before we go to the preliminary review committee, we're thinking about just a couple things. First of all, can we resolve this in some other way? And so we're thinking of it systemically. We only need the preliminary review committee to act if we need cause to proceed as a basis to file a formal complaint. And so if we can resolve something by consent, whether it's a public reprimand or a private reprimand or a diversion agreement, confidential disposition, then we don't go. We make those offers first. And it's only when they have been rejected, because they all require the attorney's consent, that we then feel that we need to go forward. There are some more serious matters where we are not thinking a reprimand or suspension or revocation is appropriate. In those cases, we go directly, but that's really not a group of cases you're concerned about. The public reprimands every year are about 5 or 6% of our formal investigations, and the private reprimands are probably a similar percent. Diversions are going to be about, most of them are at intake, so it's very few that happen at formal investigation. So if we just take the number last year is 1,600 grievances, 160 of them went to formal investigation, and most of them, probably close to 100 of them, were dismissed. If you take the 10%, you're looking at 16% of them that would have been public and private reprimands, probably 8 of them that would have been private reprimands, roughly. And the annual report that we file has the specific data The next one will be published at the end of September. It'll be delivered to you.
So, and I'm a new guy here. So, when you get to the PRC stage, this is something that you've already sort of determined you want to go there. And so, more or less, when they say go, you're go forward. That's what you're looking for anyway. And so, it'd be extraordinarily rare that you would have that determination and then not issue a formal complaint. Or is there more negotiation that occurs during that time frame?
There is. There is a small period of time after the PRC finding. Typically, we either know that there's not going to be consent or that it needs to be a suspension revocation. But there are some cases that it may be at that public reprimand level or maybe at a private reprimand level, and there is negotiation going on. And that most often occurs before we go to the PRC because we're making the offer in advance. But sometimes, even after there's cause to proceed, there's another request to talk about it and to consider precedent and to discuss what's the appropriate disposition. These would be very few cases, however, where there would be a decision made after that point to take something that we thought would be public and make it private, or a private reprimand and make it a diversion. So you'll see that complaints are filed, probably a small number, but maybe two or three during the course of a fiscal year where OLR files a public complaint seeking a private reprimand. That does happen. So we get in that little bit of an anomaly, but even if it's going to be a private disposition we seek, if there's not consent to, we're going to go forward. But I think it's important for you to know that there is a possibility that a public PRC finding could result in a private disposition. It already happens in some sense, even after the court's public proceeding. But it wouldn't be that many. There'd be, and I can't recall a specific one, but I'm sure there have been some.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Attorney Ranney?
I don't think I'm going to need 10 minutes unless your honors have additional questions for me. I'd just like very briefly to respond to Justice Hagedorn's question about other states. Attorney Schwarzenbart mentioned Alabama's treatment of the firm notification rule. I just would like to tell the court we did take a look early in the process at what various other states do as far as confidentiality in general. It was not honestly terribly useful because it turns out that states are all over the lot on what they do. There, we did not find any kind of model rule, ABA or otherwise, dealing with confidentiality issues. It's highly customized by each state, so we went ahead, took the existing rules, and kind of tried to balance interests of firms, consumers of legal services, and lawyers, as we've described already. I think I've outlined the committee's position as to the issues here today. I think people who have had criticisms and concerns have very ably delineated the questions that need to be asked and their position, and I really have nothing further to say that wouldn't be repetition. If anybody on the court has any questions.
Any questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. And again, the thanks of the court to Judge Patak for taking on what I'm sure he thought was a 9-month project, which obviously has not. I know we will be seeing more petitions from the committee, but at this point, we want to thank each and every one of you for the work that you did on the committee and for taking time out of what I know are your busy schedules to come and speak with the court again about some very, very important policy matters. So we very much appreciate your assistance. The court is now going to adjourn, and we will meet in closed conference at 1:30. We are adjourned.